Well, that's Larry Gray on the bass solo there, starting off this track. Anyway, just a second here. And Joel Gray, and it's time to go. Anyway, here, the amazing pianist Donnie Heitler in a different format than his usual. He's gotten rather ubiquitous, playing three or four nights a week on piano. It's a really deep repertoire, so ask him for a request. It's time for the Labor Hour. Opinions are those of the speakers. Thanks again for listening and batten down the hatches.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air at WFT, listener-supported community radio station in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers, do not necessarily represent those of WFT station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here we go with some underwriting announcements. This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the underemployed helpline, you can call 217-328-2295. And Illinois World Labor Hour is also supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And program on the World Labor Hour is also supported in part by the listeners of WFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to affect excellence and equity in public education and be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. And programming on World Labor Hour is also supported in part by Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And finally, the Graduate Employees Organization Union, the GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WFT Community Radio Station. Okay, well, Happy New Year, everybody. And just to let you know that we're going to be having a guest call in from New York City, Mike Biello, who's a rank-and-file member of the Carpenters Union there. He's going to be talking about past corruption in the Carpenters, the New York City District Council of Carpenters, current government oversight and abuse of power, as well as the future for the construction industry and union workers in general, and workers in general, I should say, in the New York City area and across the nation. So we're going to be listening to a little music here before we get into the news stories and stuff. This is from James McMurtry. It's called Can't Make It Here Anymore. I thought this would be a good one to start out the New Year's show. Considering 2014, we can probably expect a lot more austerity from our government that's controlled by corporate America. So we got to be prepared for it and fight back, of course. So here's James McMurtry. We Can't Make It Here Anymore, and we'll be right back.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far $5.15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. School girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus or hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Shirts in a Walmart store, just like the ones we made before, except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin, or the shape of their eyes, or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams. All lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they've never known need. The shit don't stink and the kids won't bleed. The kids won't bleed in the damn little war. And we can't make it here anymore.
That's James McMurtry, "We Can't Make It Here Anymore." And that's right, their kids aren't going to bleed in their wars that's going on. It's only going to be working class kids.
Yeah, and, you know, like George Bush didn't bleed too much 40 years ago.
In the Air National Guard, in which he didn't show up most of the time. Yeah, indeed, indeed. Yeah, it's amazing about George Bush, too, how somebody with a D average in high school can get into Yale.
Well, Dave, and, you know, I really am surprised a lot of this stuff. With if you think of the people who are now prominent, say George Bush,
yeah.
Harvard, Yale,
yeah.
Yale, Harvard MBA. Before that, you know, I can't remember the prep school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Ted Cruz,
yeah,
Harvard Law School,
mm-hmm.
And the man has no. I just can't believe it because he. I wouldn't think he'd be a big legacy like George Bush and slide through, but how can you go through all of that education and have these ridiculous superstitions? I mean, it's why isn't it like when we were young, you know, where you kind of rebelled against your dad when he had crazy right-wing ideas? Well, I know, Dave, your dad was a good union man. My dad was a farmer, and he was pretty right-wing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I ended up, and this Ted Cruz, you know, and other ones. You know, Michelle Bachmann's got a law degree, used to work for the IRS.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of these people are, they know better, but they're appealing to a certain base. I mean, you know, identity politics, again, that's how they divide us here. You know, and don't ever be fooled. Barack Obama and Bonner are working hand in glove to try to privatize your Social Security and Medicare. It's just that they got to put on a show that there's actually a choice in this country between the party of good and the party of evil, depending on what your politics are. But the bottom line is both the Democratic Party, for the most part, and the Republican Party, for sure, are basically trying to pursue the best economic agenda they can for the ruling elite and trying to take more and more away from working people. And I can guarantee you 2014 is going to that whole effort of austerity, pushing our standard of living down farther for working people is going to intensify.
Yeah, Dave, and by the way, too, I think you might have me cranked up a little high. I think I'm distorting a little bit. I strongly suggest that people, after the show, get online and search The Authoritarian's PDF.
Mm-hmm.
What that is, it's a full-length book on PDF for free by a Canadian professor, and he's been studying authoritarianism since 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the study of authoritarianism is usually authoritarian followers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they're considered, and excuse me for saying okay over it again, I guess, placeholder. It's a personality type with several traits. And what he has also found, too, is they also started studying authoritarian leaders more lately.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called dominators.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing you can have, and see, a dominator as an authoritarian leader has no principles. They're basically the psychopaths that run our societies in mm-hmm. a lot of ways, especially. And then there's what they call double highs, which are both high authoritarian followers and high dominators,
mm-hmm.
which are especially deadly.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this sort of general group of people consists of 26% of basically the American population.
You know, that reflects a lot of polls I've been observing over the years. You know, that 26% is... You know, roughly around 26%, 23 to 29%, as you see this consistently, you know, in the polls over the years on certain on a lot of issues.
Well, yeah, and, well, basically it's a normal curve,
mm-hmm.
or the infamous bell curve, you might say, but applied in the correct manner, mm-hmm. not like Charles Murray did against basically minorities,
mm-hmm.
And that's what. Which also means, Dave, that on the other end of that curve, there's a tail of about 26% of people who are very non-authoritarian, mm-hmm. very anti-authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the good news. And some other good news is that this professor has said that there is a change, that this changes over culture, even though it may be partly caused by evolutionary psychology and such and tendencies. He said that there's been a big change since 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, anyway, I just think that's an important thing that people need to think about, especially in these days of social media when you start arguing with people,
mm-hmm.
because these people, one of their major traits is they have very compartmentalized minds,
mm-hmm.
and they can take hold two completely opposite opinions very easily about different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just amazing. I highly recommend people read that book.
Okay, yeah, that's quite interesting, Bill. Thanks for sharing with that with us. And you know, one of these days we got to do a show on Edward Bernays because I think his propaganda techniques are being applied today, even though he started doing it almost a century ago, actually.
Well, what's going on is if you watch the 3-part documentary by Adam Curtis called Century of the Self,
mm-hmm.
the similar strategies are going on as far as what they want to do with the country, with the people,
mm-hmm.
but what they did, there was kind of a switch in the 60s and 70s over to the more Maslowian, mm-hmm. I guess Maslow-esque self-actualization principle. Remember, be all that you can
yeah,
be.
Yeah, yeah.
You deserve a break today.
Yeah,
okay.
The me generation, I guess. Okay, South Korean railway workers have returned to work after waging the longest strike in the country's history against the right-wing Thatcherite government of President Park Geun-hye. The strike didn't achieve its aim of preventing the government from taking what workers believe are steps towards railroad privatization. Despite striking for 23 days, they were unable to achieve their central goal of stopping the Korean government from establishing and licensing a stock company to run the new Suseo KTX line. The government rushed through this process process in a maneuver that was cowardly and legally questionable. The KRWU has filed a suit for the cancellation of the Suseo KTX company's operating license, the union said in its message to the international labor movement. The union has decided to accept a deal in which a government committee will be set up in order to head off rail privatization. This seems an unlikely possibility. Not being there, it's impossible to tell whether the balance of forces were in the workers' favor, and that a strike could have backed the government off, but placing faith in state agencies, corporate political parties, and their courts, as opposed to spreading the strike, which appears from the outside to have had considerable support, is not likely to produce the same desired results. From reports, it seems that many rank-and-file workers will be taking some form of action on the job aimed at pressuring the state to back off of its privatization plan. Okay, also, Cambodia police killed 4 workers and wounded 20 on Friday as workers demonstrated for doubling the minimum wage. Cambodia sends more than $4 billion worth of garments to the rest of the world. It employs about 500,000 workers in 500 factories producing garments and footwear. Many of these factories are foreign-owned, and the industry, much like the industry in Bangladesh, is rife with abuse and poor working conditions. The head of the military police made it clear what their goal was. Quote, "We're just doing our job," he says. "We fear the security situation, so we have to crack down on them. If we allow them to continue the strike later on, it'll become messy and more complicated to control."
Dave.
Yes.
Perfect right-wing authoritarian thinking, according to that book.
Yes.
That statement there just almost encapsulated.
Yes, indeed. And the other question is, who do the police actually serve and protect? Definitely not these workers or the citizens at large in society, but the ruling wealthy elites, just like in this country, just a little bit more subtle. Anyway, it comes as no surprise that the highly controlled and censored U.S. media fails to report on such monstrous and earth-shattering events. After all, Hillary Clinton has a new hairstyle with bangs, apparently. The silence.
Is she still into pantsuits?
It seems like it, yes. The silence of the heads of organized labor in the U.S. is what is really deafening, though. The U.S. labor movement, in order to strengthen ties with Cambodia workers and to change the passive victim-like role they place their members in as a response to this corporate offensive home, could organize and mobilize the blacklisting of all Cambodian-made goods until the workers' demands are met and the strike victorious. The murders of the striking workers should also be brought to justice. As we've talked many times in this program, where is our union leadership? I mean, they're not even seen, much less heard. Not on the talk shows, not out there advocating on the cutting edge of the issues here. It's just reactive at best, and then very late, and then very milquetoast at best as far as what they propose, as far as some kind of solution, as opposed to being on the offensive and actually doing real things to make real changes. It's just definitely a little bit discouraging.
Yeah, I'm looking for something right now, Dave. Would you happen to have a story about a new Mother Jones museum?
No.
Okay.
I think I heard something about that. Where's that going to be, in Springfield or?
Actually, for Mount Olive, and I have the article here if I can.
Oh, well, good for Mount Olive. It's a very small town, and besides, they get an amazing number of visitors there every year, and I think they have, I know at the Mother Jones Dinner in Springfield, I think it's in October every year, they have a pilgrimage to the cemetery, but that'd be great.
Mount Olive used to have like a Mother Jones Day, which is sort of like a community celebration, I believe. It was an annual thing, and I don't think it's been happening maybe for the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much they knew or related to Mother Jones, whether it just became some annual street fair or
yes,
something.
Yes.
But anyway, it's going to be built in conjunction with a new city hall complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the city of Mount Olive a few years ago was awarded $100,000 State Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity grant to build a Mother Jones Museum, but it never got off the ground. Somebody they quote here is somebody that we know, Dave, and was actually mentioned, I believe, last week on the show, and that's Rosemary Foyer.
Okay.
An associate professor of history at Northern Illinois University who specializes in labor and social history of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And she's, besides that, this is going to be part of, she's got a larger project that she's working on.
Mm-hmm.
And she has applied for a National Endowment for the Humanities grant for it. And it's a labor trail project through Illinois that pretty much follows the old Route 66.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that's something we probably need to be looking up for. Maybe when I get my video gear all happening. We can
make a trip on Route 66.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good little project, Bill.
Yeah, that's Rosemary Foyer. She used to live in St. Louis and was part of a labor TV project.
Labor Vision, yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. Labor Vision, that's mm-hmm. correct.
You know, that would be right because you think about Chicago, everything up there, Pullman strike, the Haymarket riot and stuff. I mean, that's where Route 66 starts and then goes through Bloomington, Springfield, Mount Olive. Yeah, that's quite interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of other places in Southern Illinois, too, where there's a lot of labor history that happened. You know,
yeah, several mining-related massacres,
yes.
mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, which would... I think be right along that route there.
Yes,
Verdon.
Yes. Yep.
Pena.
Uh huh. Yes, indeed. Okay. And one final story here. January 1st. In other words, just 3 days ago, it was the 20th anniversary of the enactment of the North American Free Trade Agreement, otherwise known as NAFTA, and the beginning of the Zapatista movement in Mexico. 1 year later, on January 1st, 1995, the World Trade Organization took effect, and many campaigns and movements have developed as a result of corporate globalization and the organizing in response to it by a wide variety of movements and networks of people. We can see the roots of the ongoing struggle in the United States, as well as the global revolt against neoliberalism, corporatization, and big finance capitalism. Corporate globalization attempts to put forward, but is faltering, while the movements from below seem to be rising. Knowing that makes a commentary by one writer ever more valid. Quote, the global corporate system isn't a triumphant monster, but a brittle, ungainly, jerry-rigged contraption whose managers are vainly scrambling to hold it together against a rising tide of crisis. See the issues that engage your activism in that light, not as though you're desperate, but as though the system is more or less, just barely hanging on. So, I mean, that's definitely some encouragement. And I think it's very significant that we remember the 20th anniversary of the passage of the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, because right now, as we speak, they're trying to push through something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which really has not as much to do about trade, but has to do with corporate power, about basically where corporations will be able to undermine, override, and subvert any national, state, or local laws that they don't like, that the people pass either through their elected representatives or through voter referendum. Some pretty scary stuff, actually.
Yeah, and you got to hand it to, I guess, the paranoid right-wingers. These things do tend to, that destroy our sovereignty do tend to be passed under Democrats. You know, Bill Clinton, NAFTA. Yep. And DPP right now, Barack Obama. Because, like Richard Nixon,
yes,
only Richard Nixon could go
to
China.
Only a Republican could go to China, and only a Democrat can push through the austerity policies and these horrible corporate trade treaties, you know, that hurt working people worldwide, not just the United States, but only benefit the wealthy elites.
Yes, only Richard Nixon could go to China, and only Dick Durbin can cut Social Security.
Yes, along with
him. Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is just, shows you what corporate money has done, you know, to our whole political system and our democracy.
Well, Dave, it's not just corporate money.
Mm-hmm.
It's the cultural drumbeat that's been constant since the 1970s, along with that backlash. But I think that there is hope. You know, I've been mm-hmm. reading articles lately, and unfortunately, it may be too little too late in terms of what's going on environmentally on the planet, as well as economically.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the younger people now are having a backlash against that backlash. This is time for the backlash against Reaganism.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the young people now were not around when Reagan was around.
In the Cold War.
Right. When people in their 40s were about the last ones that remember Reagan from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other cultural things that are happening, but we need to keep pushing it somehow. We need to keep creating cultural items, art, and media and be getting it out. That's one of the most important things you can do besides talk to people.
Indeed. And also your information sources. Don't watch the corporate media. I mean, you're not just misinformed, you're disinformed. Go to the internet, go to alternative news sources like Labor Hour and WFT, but also Free Speech TV,
Dave.
Late TV. Okay, I believe that's our caller calling in from New York City. And hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Mike Bellello calling from New York City.
Hi, Mike, how you doing? We got Mike Bellello on here. He's a rank-and-file member of the Carpenters Union, and you were a past elected secretary-treasurer, I believe, of the New York City District Council of Carpenters?
Executive secretary-treasurer, that's correct.
Okay. Yes, just let the listeners know, I first met Mike back in 2002 when we had our struggle, our rank-and-file revolt for democracy within the Carpenters Union. And he's been through some interesting times here since 2002, and I just thought it might be real interesting for our listeners, for you to call in and tell us a little, kind of, maybe start off by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, other than what I've said, and a little bit of the history of the New York City District Council of Carpenters.
All right. Let me start with myself. I've been a member since 1975. I started my apprenticeship back then and, learned to trade, a lot of different aspects of the trade. And I guess going into the 90s, I became more politically involved in the organization. I ran in the first member one man one vote election for district council offices in 1995, and that took place as a result of a federal consent decree that district council signed on to in the early 90s. So the members in New York City, they directly elect their district council leaders. That's the only place in the UBC where that happens. Everywhere else, it's a delegate vote for your district council offices. So I ran back in 95. It was my first election ever, actually, and I ran for a vice president's position. And I made a pretty good showing. I was a reform candidate. District council had been plagued by corruption and organized crime infiltration, and that's when I first became involved. I wasn't successful in that election, but some point after that, 1997, I became a business agent for the district council and was actually relieved of that position by the International, and went back to being a rank-and-file carpenter. And then again in 2011, I ran to top position, and I was elected to that position.
Why do you think you were the real reason? Why was the? You think the real reason was that you were relieved of your business agent position?
Well, I was known for going after corruption. There was a lot of widespread corruption on job sites throughout the city, and I would go from job site to job site and clean it up. And stepped on a lot of people's toes doing that.
Okay.
And, so the International made a political decision at the time. We were under supervision of them, and that was a result of that political decision.
Okay. So going to 2011, then you were elected, and how long did you serve in, as the Secretary-Treasurer?
I was elected in December 2011, took office.
Okay.
Beginning of 2012,
mm-hmm.
and I served until April 30th of 2013,
mm-hmm.
and I was, used the proper term, vetoed from that position by a court-appointed review officer.
Okay. Now, at this point, we may want to explain a little bit about the court-appointed review officer. This was part of what's called, correct me if I'm wrong, a consent decree, basically, that was put in place back in the 90s to try to get rid of the influence of organized crime and corruption.
Is that correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the consent decree wasn't really successful
mm-hmm.
in accomplishing that. So in 2009, Mike Ford, who was the executive secretary treasurer, was indicted. Now, I had run against Mike Ford's position also back in 1999
mm-hmm.
and was not successful. So he was indicted in 2009. But basically, all of the things I said were going on mm-hmm. back in 1999.
Now, if I remember correctly, Mike Ford was actually accepted a $10,000 or a multi-thousand-dollar bribe from an undercover federal agent to basically allow non-union companies, mob-influenced companies, to run two crews, one at night and then on a union job site, more or less?
It was actually a lot more involved than that.
Okay.
So he had been indicted early on for taking a $10,000 bribe, but he ultimately admitted to $18 million in
going
to the New York City District Council of Carpenters benefit funds.
Oh, wow.
That's what he admitted to.
Okay.
Anyway, he was indicted in 2009, and the International put the council under supervision once again. And they signed on to a stipulation and order, which was in addition to the consent decree. And the stipulation and order gave us a review officer with powers not seen before by anything of the sort. He had the ability to say who can run in elections, set the rules for elections. He could eliminate anyone from holding a position at the council just by without any kind of real criteria.
Okay. That sounds pretty incredible, considering, I mean, basically this would supersede not just the will of the majority of the membership of the union, but also even circumvent labor laws on the books.
Absolutely.
Lanham-Griffin Act.
Labor law. I mean, mm-hmm. the LMRDA states the only prerequisite to run for office is you have to be a member in good standing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no longer the case in the New York City District Council of Carpenters.
Okay. Now, I understand that when you were in, that, you know, I've heard this from not just you, but, you know, I talked to other sources, too, you know, among them Ray Rogers, who's famous for the corporate campaign, and some other people in New York City area, saying that when you were in, that you were really doing a heck of a job. I mean, actually, you know, working for the members, you know, taking on huge entrenched corporate interests, you know, mainly developers in New York City to get union work back, working out alliances with other unions, both in and outside the building trades. And for some reason, this compliance officer, he didn't like this, in essence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I took on two different approaches to organizing.
Mm-hmm.
One that I'm especially proud of is called Build Up NYC, which is a coalition with the all the other building trades. And, you know, I started it with the laborers and the painters here. And we had a sit down one afternoon and conceived the idea. We brought it back to the building trades. They liked it. But we, you know, the three of us, the laborers, the painter, and the carpenter, were the leaders in this. And the head of the building trades then was very enthusiastic, Gary LaBarber. And he got SEIU involved. Mike Fishman at the time ran it in New York City, since then went to the International. And we put together a research department, a head organizer, everything you need for a real serious organizing campaign. SEIU offered to put up $1 million if the trades matched half of it, and we did that to start with. And we brought in the hotel trades, and, you know, we had a real coalition of people who built the buildings, people who staffed the buildings once they were built, and then the hotel trades, with the hotel industry booming here. And so we had all the bases covered.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we picked one target to start with, a developer, and within 3 months, that developer changed his policies, and he actually came in to negotiate a full agreement with the district council and with the other trades. So that was a huge victory, and it was only 3 months after conception of the whole project.
3 months that you was able. Wow, that's incredible.
3 months.
Yeah,
3 months. And since, you know, there's been a developer on Staten Island here in New York City who's never done any union work, signed a big project in Staten Island, went completely union. So, you know, it was a good approach. It was successful. And, you know, I think it's going to, you know, we haven't heard the last of it, put it that way.
Okay.
So this Ray Rogers was another campaign, corporate campaign, like mm-hmm. you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we gave him a target, and you know, if you know anything about Ray, he you know, he gets something in his sights, he goes after it. And he turned his project in 3 months. That was Tia Kreft, which is the Teachers Retirement Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, his approach, he was down in Atlanta, and you know, where they had a board meeting, handing out leaflets down there, out Rutgers College, getting college students and faculty involved in the campaign. And, you know, we didn't change the job out in Queens that we were targeting, but Tia Kreft sent their lawyers into the district council and agreed that they would change their policy about investing in non-union buildings.
Wow.
So it was a success.
Indeed, indeed. So then we go to where, I guess, this compliance officer basically vetoed your continuation as the elected head of the New York City District Council. I was wanting you to talk a little bit about that, and then your subsequent court case last summer against
right,
this.
Right. Yeah, he took issue with one thing in particular. We have the Javits Center here. It's a trade show venue that the Carpenters supply manpower to. And I had a member who was called to go to work there that was behind in his dues. And he called me one morning and said, "Hey, I got a call to go to work here. I'm behind in my dues. I did take a annuity loan out, and I'll have it overnighted to me the next day, and I'll pay my dues on Monday." I was like, okay, that'll work. And, you know, I had one thing in the back of my head is that somebody was removed from a job in recent times before that by one of our business agents for being behind in their dues. And I had to sign settlement checks for back pay for the guy because it was done illegally. You can't remove a member from a job site because he's behind in his dues. There's a whole process that has to be followed.
Mm-hmm.
So I followed that process that day, and the review officer took issue with that. I was on the side of labor law mm-hmm. and the Taylor law in this case because it's a state venue.
Mm-hmm.
And the review officer said, no, you should have knocked that member off of that job immediately. And, he vetoed me for that, and for, he had other listed issues, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and, you know, in his eyes.
Okay, and so then you went to court in August. Was it this year or July?
It finished in July.
Okay,
and you know, I had to retain an attorney. He wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't even talk to me without an attorney, he said. So I had to go through the process to hire my own attorney at my own expense. And I think they did a really good job. And unfortunately, the federal judge went on the side of the review officer. Even though we were on the right side of labor law in that particular case,
mm-hmm.
he gave this review officer the power to circumvent that.
You know, I find it quite amazing, considering Mike Ford, your predecessor, I mean, there was all sorts of allegations and evidence of how corrupt he was in the past, but he remained in his position for quite some time. I mean, even gave the endorsement of the international president Doug McCarron at the 2000 Carpenters Convention in Chicago. Yet you do something really, you think about it, not just legally you were right, but morally. I mean, obviously this member probably was hadn't worked in quite a while and fallen on some hard times. And I don't know of any business agent that has half a heart or half a grain of unionism in them that wouldn't have done the same thing you did. You know, it seems like a minor technicality, frankly.
First of all, it was the right thing to do, mm-hmm. as you just said. You know, and second of all, it was the legal way of handling the situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and it wasn't done legally once before by one of our business agents. You know, and ultimately, I had to sign checks, district council money to a member who was knocked off a job for being behind in his dues. You know, the law says you have to give them a payment plan, basically. You have to give them a written statement saying how much they owe mm-hmm. and agree upon a time in which they can pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
Usually if you're a shop steward on a job and somebody comes and they haven't worked in a while, and you say, you know, all right, get your first paycheck, and then you go down and you take care of your dues.
Yes.
You mm-hmm. know, I mean, I don't know a steward who has not come across that, but, you know, we're not here to put a fellow, a brother or a sister out of work because they haven't worked in 6 months and, they fell behind in their dues. It's just not the way we operate.
Yeah. My co-host would like to ask you a question. Bill Gorell, he's a member of the labor's union here locally.
Well, I just would bring up another way that could be handled also. And one time I got behind, and my secretary treasurer actually paid them for me temporarily. And by the Landrum Griffin Act, I believe that an officer is limited to, but can lend a member up to $2,000, but there's a limit. But I mean, usually, you know, they could cut, you could even legally cover them yourself as a loan, unless your consent decree said something about that.
No, you know, I've actually seen that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Lesser extent in other cases, or, we've had people behind in their working dues assessment, you know, some by a few dollars, and it just taking a $10 bill out of your pocket and covered it. You know, I've seen other business agents paid somebody else's dues. You're right. It happens all the time. You know, and in this case, there really wasn't any need for that to happen. The member said he was coming down on Monday. This was on a Friday. And, you know, he did.
Mm-hmm.
He did. He came down that following Monday, and he took care of his dues. There was no reason why he should have lost the day's pay that Friday.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why any of this should have happened. But,
mm-hmm. What's the name of this compliance officer that vetoed your elected position?
Dennis Walsh.
Dennis Walsh. Now, does his, I assume he works for a law firm. Do they get a certain amount of money every month for administering this consent decree?
He has his own law firm.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, he averages $85,000 a month.
$85,000 a month. So for basically, I guess what I'm getting at, he doesn't really have any kind of urgent need, let's say, to make a final report saying, well, everything's fine in the New York City Carpenters District Council. I guess my services are no longer needed. I mean, it almost sounds like he's got to constantly come up with excuses to continue his job, if you will, in order to continue that $85,000 a month flowing in.
I couldn't agree more.
Okay. I mean, it just seems kind of obvious. You know, Mike, what I think is interesting, too, is this Dennis Walsh. Who was the consent officer before him?
Before him was Kenneth Convoy.
Kenneth Convoy. Now, where do I know that name from? It sounds familiar.
He was
familiar.
What you call the investigations and review officer, and he was the original review officer when the consent decree came mm-hmm. into effect back in 1994.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, Dennis Walsh worked on his staff
okay.
back at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so he was familiar with the case, and then when this review officer position came up in 2009, 2010, he was one of the names on the list. And, you know, I'm sorry to say that the U.S. attorney asked my opinion at the time, and I said, you know, I think he would be a good choice for the position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the worst decisions or recommendations I've ever made in my life.
Oh, you're only human. It happens. Now, this Conroy, that name sounds familiar, though, beyond the Carpenters. Was he involved somehow with the Teamsters at one time?
He was, actually. Ken Conroy was the guy who knocked Ron Carey out of the box.
Ron Carey?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, how interesting. The plot thickens here. Just so listeners know that Ron Carey was the democratically elected head of the Teamsters Union, who was got brought off, if I remember correctly, was had all these indictments against him. But funny, because he was never convicted. And yet he can't serve as a union officer anymore. Just when he was getting ready to up the... He won the UPS strike nationwide, and he was just upping the ante, if you will, about having protests against NAFTA, in particular the use of Mexican trucks coming into the United States. Do I... Anything else to that, Bill?
Well, besides that, that was the first... that was the election that got James P. Hoffa elected
after Kerry was taken
out. Who is very
corporate
very corporate, very friendly to both parties, just depending on which side his bread's being buttered, whatever situation it is. Also, if you might remember, in the late 90s you were seeing Richard Trumka and Gerald McEntee being very effective spokespeople on the Washington, you know, the news chat show circuit. Everything was picking up there, but they were involved in it because they were involved in the third parties that were lending the money to, and by the way, they were taking advice of Democratic campaign advisors too.
Okay, that involved campaign money to Bill Clinton or to Al Gore, right?
No, that involved campaign money to the president of the Teamsters. God, I can't believe it's blowing my mind. Not Hoffa, the guy he ran against.
Okay, I'm drawing a blank here.
Kerry. That blew my mind. See, what happened was they arranged for other unions. It's illegal for other unions to make campaign contributions to anybody running for office in a union.
I see. Okay.
So what they did is they arranged for third parties to take money from the AFL-CIO and the AFGE and give it to Kerry's campaign.
I see.
And that way, and nobody was convicted, but all of a sudden everybody shut up and was silenced. These guys disappeared from the mainstream media. George Bush was elected. Who cares about anything having to do with nothing but this crazy 9/11?
Okay. Yeah. So we just had to give a little background there. But Mike, it just seems like with your story that, you know, you almost seem like, you know, doing the right thing. I mean, you know, for your members and everything else, following the law, and you get, you know, taken out here. And it just, it's just amazing. It seems like the similarities with other unions at different times, different places here in the United States in recent history, where every time they start making some advances, somehow some shenanigans happen, if you will, behind the scenes involving the federal government.
Yeah, you know, that's real interesting, the way you just tied it all together with the Teamsters. I have to look at it in a whole other light. You know, when you're at the district council and you're trying to get that place functional and, you know, get it to be something great again, and you have all that going on, you know, you don't realize even the bigger picture going on, you know, like, you know, what happened with Kerry and all of that. And, you know, it just, you know, shows the magnitude of what organized labor is up against.
Yes, indeed. Now, back to sort of the legal aspect of the court cases. First question is, the case that you you took to court back in that ended in July, were you planning to appeal that sometime soon? Or?
No, that's done.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's the money and all that. I mean, time, money, it's very costly. I mean,
I spent $60,000.
Of your own money?
Of my own money.
Wow.
You know, on that. You know, I'm actually paying that down now, fortunately. My attorney, you know, saw fit to allow me to do it that way.
But, okay.
You know.
All right.
Yeah. You know.
And
you know, I just had to, you know, cut my losses at that point. It didn't, you know, it didn't look promising mm-hmm. for an appeal anyway. So it just didn't make sense at that point.
Okay. Now, wasn't there another case going to court here just yesterday involving the same compliance officer, it's Dennis Walsh,
yes.
about where he basically disqualified some people for running for district council?
He did.
Okay. And what happened there?
He did. Well, the court hearing didn't take place yesterday because of the snowstorm.
Oh, okay.
So it's been rescheduled for 9:30 Monday morning.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what's going to happen on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
There is an election taking place to replace my position or to elect somebody else to hold the position that I was vetoed from.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing happens in court Monday morning, Monday afternoon, the ballots will be mailed out to the membership.
Okay. All right.
So, you know, we'll know more Monday morning how that plays out.
Okay. Well, Mike, of course, you got my email and stuff, and I really appreciate you, you know, keeping me updated on this because we'd like
absolutely.
To, you know, report on this as the as things, you know, transpire here.
Oh, by the way, Mike, I'm a laborer, and my local here in Champaign-Urbana was taken under trusteeship itself, and our international has been under a big consent decree and everything else. And I'm not trying to reflect on the individual local people or, you know, or like that, but I have found that there has been no increase in actual democracy in our union. It's pro forma, but not actual informed consent of the membership.
No, it works quite the opposite,
mm-hmm.
is what I find. You know, really what happens is the members get even more disenfranchised and they become less engaged with what goes on.
Yeah, and, you know, I've heard from some members of your local, Bill, that even though they were big critics of the previous corrupt administration that ruled, what, 20, 30 years in your local, yeah, that they actually reminisce for it now because at least they got some representation from this guy.
Well, yeah, maybe that's sort of like older people of Russia reminiscing for the Soviet Union.
Well,
I don't know, but
why in that case, too?
Well, but they did have their good sides. They actually organized several new bargaining units, mm-hmm. especially at the University of Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and they would come out and metaphorically kick ass.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they ever actually kicked somebody's. I don't know. They might have, but they would clear the hall out to go attack job sites, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, now it's all, we went straight from the mob to business.
Corporatism.
Yes.
And it sounds like that's kind of a similar thing.
Sort of like fascism, isn't it?
Well, this sounds like a very similar situation to what you've experienced in New York City, too, Mike, isn't it?
Oh, I reminisce for the old days myself. I never thought I'd get to the point where I'd say we were better off when the mob was running the place.
How?
The government.
Wow.
You know, you got a review officer here who... he's taking money out of the organization,
mm-hmm.
and all he's doing is weakening us. When we make some successful things happen, he does what he can to derail them.
That's quite a summation in a nutshell. I mean, with your story,
you know, you never think you can get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have someone here that's doing. There may be more damage, and he's doing it under the guise of a court-appointed officer. But yet here's a guy who went into court and he lied to the judge, with me sitting there, and he fabricated a whole thing, you know, about me making a false statement, which I did not. And I'm listening to him make a false statement. And I'm saying, what is wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
Okay, Mike. You know, we got to get going here. Is there anything that anybody can do for you or any places where they could get information about your case, anything like that?
Well, it's all public information.
As a matter of fact, I'm reading a New York Times article about it right now.
Oh, you pulled up one?
Oh, yeah. I just Googled his name.
Okay.